Wednesday. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.
Okie doke, greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live, May 17, 2009, on WILL AM 580, based here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is one of the really outstanding journalists of the past two decades, and for my money, one of the most interesting writers in the country today. We'll be talking to Chris Hedges, author of numerous books, columnist, expert on U.S. foreign policy, among many other things. It should be a wonderful hour. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy the show with us. Before we go to Chris Hedges, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
There are 2.3 million people in prison in America, and their families, disproportionately poor and people of color, are bearing the burden of paying for excessively high telephone bills to keep in touch with their loved ones. Dharma Daily has been researching the issue for the Media Justice Fund. Their report, Criminal Charges, has just been released.
In the 1960s, social science researchers noticed that there was a relationship between people being able to stay in contact with their families and their communities and recidivism. And that relationship is that the more capacity somebody had to stay in contact with loved ones, the less likely they were to wind up back in prison. And when they got out, the more likely they were to be able to find work, maintain work, and so on.
Building on that research, reform was undertaken throughout the country to introduce phones into the prison system. But with the breakup of AT&T's phone monopoly in 1985, came unforeseen changes to prison phone systems, a niche market around prison phone service.
Phone service providers found a way to get an edge on getting prison phone contracts, and that was to offer a commission to the prison systems or to the states. It's called commissions by the prison systems, but it's called kickbacks by the families.
The average kickback today is about 40%. A typical interstate call from a prison has a $3.95 connection fee and rates per minute as high as 89 cents. Grassroots advocates have been fighting for lower phone rates for many years, and they have gotten some results in some states. 29 states now offer imprisoned people the option of debit or prepaid calling. 5 states have laws against commissions, and some local ordinances to regulate prison phone contracts have been enacted. But there is more to be done. Daly says the best government agency to make strong policy is the Federal Communications Commission.
Ultimately, the FCC has an unquestionable authority to regulate interstate communication. And the act that created the FCC, the Communication Act of the 1930s, specifically mandated the FCC to, in the words of the act, regulate just and reasonable rates.
Families of prisoners hope that the FCC will cap rates for interstate calls, and that federal action will have a cascading effect on in-state phone calls as well. Daly hopes that the commission will look at the disparity between falling phone call rates for average consumers and rising rates for prisoners' families. To read the report, Criminal Charges, go to the Media Justice Fund at fex.org/MJF.
4 of the 5 top TV news stations announced a joint venture to share news gathering resources. Managers say it's more cost-effective to share staff and equipment, but Chicago's WLS-TV general manager Emily Barr refused the offer to join them.
News is 100% of our image, so I won't do anything to harm that. And I think we have to remain distinctive and we have to have a voice that is different from everybody else's. Otherwise, why bother watching us?
WLS is an ABC-owned station. NBC, Fox, CBS, and Tribune will be pooling their video crews to cover events such as press conferences and car accidents. But Barr says that arrangement doesn't leave room for spontaneity or creativity.
yes, you may shoot the press conference itself collectively the way everybody else does, but as soon as that individual steps off the podium or something might happen off to the left or off to the right or you need to get a reaction from someone else, that's precisely when you need your camera crew and your reporter working in tandem to get the story.
Barr says video is the very thing that distinguishes TV from radio and print.
Our pictures and sound are what make us different from the way news is gathered for radio or for print. If you're going to say that all video is essentially the same at these kinds of things, then you're really diminishing the importance of that, and it doesn't make sense to me.
With advertising dollars disappearing, stations are under pressure to cut costs.
Most television stations and many radio stations are owned by companies that own multiple outlets. So there's pressure to perform. I think we're all in that same boat in that respect.
But Barr says it's important to keep competing voices in the media.
I like it when the TV station across the street comes after us and tries to get a story that we're trying to get. And, you know, I don't like it when we get beat, but I also think it makes us wake up and say, you know, we're not all that. We need to step it up. It's good for us, and I think it's good for the entire media world to have a vibrant, competitive environment. Keeps everybody on their toes, and frankly, it probably keeps us honest.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 17, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this lovely late spring, early summer day. Our guest today is Chris Hedges, who was a foreign correspondent for nearly two decades for the New York Times, the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor, and National Public Radio. Chris Hedges was a member of the team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting, and he received the 2002 Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. Hedges is the author of numerous books, including the bestseller American Fascist and the book War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He is presently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and a Lannan Literary Fellow, and he has taught at Columbia, NYU, and Princeton. He's also the author of the new book, America's New Fundamentalist, When Atheism Becomes Religion. It's a pleasure to have Chris Hedges join us today in Media Matters. Mr. Hedges?
Yes.
Thank you for joining us and taking time from your schedule.
I'm happy to do it.
First of all, there's so much ground to cover with the body of work you have on foreign policy and American politics, on religion, on the Christian right in the United States. If we could just start with a little bit of your background for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with you. How much time did you work as a foreign correspondent? Where were you based? What did you cover?
I spent almost 20 years as a foreign correspondent, most of that with the New York Times. I started as a freelance journalist in the early 1980s in South America. I actually covered the Falkland War out of Buenos Aires for National Public Radio. Went to Central America, where I spent 5 years covering the war in El Salvador, Nicaragua, as well as the civil war in Guatemala. I then took a sabbatical to study Arabic. I was with the Dallas Morning News then. Went to Jerusalem, covered the Middle East out of Jerusalem. Then was hired by the New York Times, covered the first Gulf War. I spent a total of 7 years in the Middle East. And then went in 1995 to the Balkans to cover the war in the former Yugoslavia, where I was based in Sarajevo, and then, of course, the war in Kosovo, and then I was based in Paris covering al-Qaeda in Europe and North Africa. And I have a funny academic background because I never studied journalism. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School with a Master of Divinity, which means I did all the academic work to become a minister, although I wasn't ordained. So I have obviously a strong foundation in Christian ethics and theology, and then, from years of living abroad, a deep familiarity with many of the issues, especially in the Middle East, that are at the center of foreign policy. And then, of course, because most of the countries I was in were at war, I tended to leap from conflict to conflict, and I have, unfortunately, a very intimate understanding of violence and what it does to individuals and societies, and attempted to explain that the poison of war in my first book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning.
Our guest, Chris Hedges, today, you've just been listening to him, the author, former New York Times reporter. And Mr. Hedges, you know, I've had a chance to read a lot of your material. And just this weekend, I read your book, When Atheism Becomes Religion. I want to talk about that later, but I really want to talk about the foreign policy issues and war and peace issues first. And I was struck when I was reading not just this book, but your articles at truthdig.com, which I think is a weekly column you write there.
Every Monday.
Every Monday.
This is Bob Shearer's website.
Bob Shearer's website. And it's an exceptional column. I urge people to go to it and read it. But what strikes me is you write with considerable authority about the Muslim world and about war and peace in general. But I get the sense in all your writings that there is a real dismay, concern about the ignorance the American people have and the American government has about the Middle East, the Islamic world. Is that fair to say?
Yes, and I think the ignorance is very real and very dangerous, because we're, of course, waiting all over the Middle East in an area that we largely don't understand. You know, we painted it with that monolithic brush that people used to paint communism with. And I covered the fall of East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. And, you know, just from those three examples, these were very different places. And that is also true not only within the Muslim world, I mean, in that Algeria is not Iraq, is not Egypt, but you see it within Islamic movements themselves, which are frequently at odds with each other. When you cover these movements, they tend to divide very sharply among movements that are national in orientation, i.e. their goal is to achieve power within the country that they are in. Hamas would be a good example. I think most Americans don't understand that not only are Hamas and Al-Qaeda antagonistic entities, but when Hamas decided through Egyptian intermediaries last year to try and negotiate a ceasefire, which sadly the Israelis decided to destroy, a halt to the rocket attacks and a kind of truce, Hamas was denounced as apostates by Al-Qaeda. I mean, these kinds of nuances are lost in the rhetoric of, fist-pounding and stereotyping. And so we sort of lumber around the Middle East blind, a large child with bombs. And almost everything we're doing is counterproductive.
Let's go through a few of those things, since they are really central to global politics today and American politics right now. First, the big story in the news of the last several weeks, but it keeps coming back, which is the entire case of torture. And now we have, the controversy over whether the Obama administration is going to be very interested in pursuing this to a legal end. And the repeated admissions by former Vice President Cheney that, indeed, torture, for all intents and purposes, something he did and did proudly. What is your response to how this is playing out in the United States and in the U.S. media? And then what's your sense of how it's playing in the Middle East and in the Islamic world?
Well, first of all, once you have to use torture, your intelligence system is broken and doesn't work. That is, an extremely inefficient and useless enterprise, as any good intelligence officer will tell you. The torture works to the extent that you can get people initially to say things that are true, but then you keep torturing, and they will just begin saying what you want to hear to make the pain stop. And so good intelligence officials will often complain. You don't know where that line is. You don't know when you can be acting on intelligence that is completely fictional, to your own detriment. Good intelligence officers, and I've known many over the years, do what good foreign correspondents do. They are linguistically, culturally, and historically literate. you know, the great complaint, the great failure of the CIA to grasp the social movements that brought down the Shah were because the CIA officials, many of whom were ex-military, were sitting around with the Iranian military instead of sitting quietly with the capacity to, of course, understand Farsi and listen to what the clerics were saying in the back, you know, in the mosques in Qom. You know, torture is, you know, what you do in desperation. And unfortunately, once you begin to torture, you empower sadists and killers, people who torture for torture's sake, because it makes them, gives them a kind of godlike power, you know, over another human being. You know, I saw this constantly in war. We used to have an expression, give a 19-year-old kid an AK-47, and it takes them about 4 days to become God. That power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth, it's a very heady. And, of course, much is the same is true when you begin to inflict that kind of physical abuse, that capacity to break people down. I mean, what's interesting about American torture is that it resembles so closely the kind of scientific methods that were used by the East German Stasi. You know, they don't break bones the way the Gestapo did. They break souls. It's complete disorientation, sensory deprivation, which we know can reduce a human being to a kind of catatonic state. How useful is it in terms of the quote-unquote war against terror, which is something else we can discuss? I think it's virtually useless, and in many cases counterproductive. How does this play out in the rest of the world? Well, you know, this is going to take a huge bite out of Obama's image, because I think many people, not only in the Muslim world, but certainly within Europe and beyond, saw in Obama somebody who would seek to restore the rule of law. Unfortunately, that's something that the Obama administration has decided not to do.
Our guest today, Chris Hedges. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Chris Hedges, the number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Chris Hedges, the author of numerous books, including American Fascist and War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and also the brand new book, or relatively brand new book, When Atheism Becomes Religion. A lot to talk about with Chris Hedges. Please call and join us if you'd like. You know, one of the ways I became first familiar with your work, Mr. Hedges, was when you gave the commencement speech at Rockford College in 2003, I believe it was, shortly after the mission accomplished speech by President Bush, then President Bush, and you were hollered off the stage by irate audience members who thought you were being disrespectful of the president when you criticized the war. And it's not unlike Michael Moore at the Academy Awards in the sense that history, I think, as the line goes, has absolved you and then some. But what occurs to me from that event is, you know, we've now seen since 2003, the Iraq war has fallen from the news to a certain extent, but it's also been repackaged as a victory of the surge and things are now working out there and we're on the home stretch. Is that, do you think what we're being told in the news media in that perspective is an accurate playing out of what's taking place in Iraq today?
No. Iraq has been destroyed as a unified country. That experiment that rose out of disintegration of the Ottoman Empire is finished and is not coming back. What we've done is partition Iraq, and not only partition the country, but literally partition neighborhood from neighborhood in cities like Baghdad. There has been a frightening ethnic cleansing, which we have tacitly empowered, allowing, for instance, the Sunnis to drive Shiites out of villages and enclaves and neighborhoods that they control, allowing Shiites to do the same, standing by passively as the Kurds do that in northern Iraq, especially in the city of Kirkuk, which is very important to the Kurds because it's oil-rich, and if they don't control Kirkuk, northern Iraq is not sustainable as a Kurdish enclave. We tried a very similar process in the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, where we bought off tribal groups through with money. And remember, we're paying 100,000 Sunni militia members salaries of $300 a month, a fairly significant figure in Iraqi society. And these you know, these tribal groups, once they collected money, or once the money stopped, or once they got enough weapons, drifted right back into the arms of the Taliban. So the Sunnis have no loyalty, and in fact a great deal of animosity toward the Shiite-dominated central government. It's important to remember that the Sunnis in under Saddam Hussein comprise the hierarchy of the military, all of the six major intelligence agencies, all of the special forces units. There's a lot of skill which, you know, once they were able to come out from under the shadows of an insurgency, they have been able to organize and marshal. So the surge was a clever tactic in that it, you know, for a while mollified. You know, remember the huge car bombings and killings in 2006 when really the mission was collapsing. But over the long term, we don't own these people, we rent them. And when they turn on us, and there are signs that they already are turning as I speak, remember there's been a spate of suicide bombings in the last couple of weeks in Baghdad. This war will once again, I think, unleash the kind of carnage that we saw a couple of years ago. It's not a sustainable, the occupation is not sustainable in Iraq, just as it is not sustainable in Afghanistan.
Well, before we go to Afghanistan, just to complete the point here on Iraq, do you sense there's a difference between the Obama administration's policies in Iraq from those of the Bush administration?
No. It's virtually the same. And it's the same with McCain. I mean, there was a, you know, they're going to try and pull off occupation light in Iraq. I'm not sure it's going to work. Remember that they're leaning very heavily on a huge mercenary force in Iraq. And they are going to not bring these people home, but largely transfer them to the Afghan theater because Afghanistan is really deteriorating. And I think that's probably it's the precariousness of the Karzai government and the rapid expansion of Taliban control is perhaps not as widely understood, certainly understood by the Obama administration and its national security team, but probably the American public doesn't realize how dangerous the situation in Afghanistan has become for NATO troops.
What would happen, Chris Hedges, do you think, if the United States simply withdrew as quickly as humanly possible from both Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, that's what I don't want to see happen.
Well, it won't happen. Don't worry. I was just curious.
I mean, I don't want to see the mission collapse. And then, you know, as you've seen this, go back and look what happened with, you know, the partition plan with India and Pakistan, or the abrupt British withdrawal from Palestine, which triggered the 1948 war. I mean, this is the kind of thing you don't want to see, or Vietnam. But, of course, if they don't begin planning for it, that is what will happen. You have to negotiate with the Taliban. It's not a very pleasant, I mean, they're not a very pleasant group, but unfortunately they now control at least 50% of the country, probably more. They're pulling in, according to the United Nations, $300 million a year from a resumption of the poppy and heroin trade. It's because Afghanistan is very different from Iraq. Because you have decentralized authority, and because the Pashtuns, who held power in 2001 and who were removed, have made this unholy alliance with the Taliban. You have, and remember, there are 23 million Pashtuns in Pakistan and 18 million in Afghanistan. We cut the tribal lines. We didn't do it. The British did it right in the middle. We virtually have declared war on significant numbers of Pakistanis and Afghanis, and this is tearing apart Pakistan, just as it is tearing apart Afghanistan. I mean, you know, the only way out of this is, and I think it's important to remember that what is fueling this tacit support in Afghanistan for the Taliban is the utter incompetence and corruption and brutality of the Karzai government. I mean, you saw a similar situation in Gaza where people just got so sick of the PLO or Fatah. You know, these guys were coming back from Tunis and building villas by the sea and driving around in tax-free Mercedes that they had imported, that people turned in frustration and anger to Hamas. And I think in Afghanistan you're seeing the same kind of revulsion at the Karzai administration. These guys are just phenomenally corrupt and abusive. And so people are once again walking into the embrace of the Taliban for much the same reason.
And just to sum up, your sense is that the Obama administration's surge in Afghanistan is not going to solve the problem.
Well, they're hanging on by their fingertips. I mean, if you watch the news reports closely, you know, there are attacks being carried out. It was just one the other day in the center of Kabul. As a foreigner, you can't walk around, if you look like me, I have blonde hair, if you can't walk around the streets of Kabul, it's too dangerous. You have to get into a cab and forget going outside the city limits unless you're embedded with the NATO forces. That's also true in Kandahar. And, I mean, when the Human Rights Report went to do its report on civilian bombings, which is, of course, another huge issue, their representatives couldn't leave Kandahar. They had to hire Afghans to bring people who had been affected by the bombing into the city to interview. It was just too dangerous to go out on the roads. And they know that. I mean, and of course, we will see a huge upsurge, as we always do, in the summer months in the fighting. And that's why they're rushing to get as many, I think, what is, they have 20,000 in now, they're going up to 30. I mean, that's why they're doing this as quickly as they can, because Karzai is in deep trouble. And so are we.
Our guest, Chris Hedges, author of When Atheism Becomes Religion, author of American Fascist, and also author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, a longtime correspondent for the New York Times, based all over the world in just about every major war zone of the past two decades, at least into the early part of this decade. If you'd like to call in and talk with Chris Hedges, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And Mr. Hedges, when I was listening to you and I've been reading your stuff, I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, that as a consequence of your commencement address at Rockford College, there was pressure on the New York Times to reprimand you for taking such a strong opinion on the war, and the paper did actually do some sort of reprimand. Is that correct?
Yes. I had been, my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, had come out in the fall of 2002, and of course I'd just come from the, you know, I'd spent 7 years in the Middle East, and inevitably I would be asked on Charlie Rose and all these kinds of shows what I thought about the impending invasion of Iraq. And like any Arabist, including all the Arabists in the State Department, the intelligence community, and the Pentagon, I realized that invading Iraq was a disaster, that we wouldn't be greeted as liberators, that democracy would not be implanted in Baghdad and emanate outwards across the Middle East, that the oil revenues wouldn't pay for the reconstruction. I mean, this was a non-reality-based belief system, one championed by lunatics like Wolfowitz and Pearl and Cheney, none of whom know anything about the Middle East or, frankly, you know, the world outside of the backstabbing corridors of Washington. And I also understood as a news reporter that to make those kinds of statements was to court professional suicide. But there were so few voices and so few Arabists who were being heard that I felt a kind of moral imperative to speak. And after I was booed off of the stage at Rockford College for saying all of this, it got picked up by the trash talk media, you know, O'Reilly, the typical, and somebody got, you can actually watch it on YouTube, somebody got, you know, home movie footage of it, and they were flashing that all over Fox, and so the Times was pressured to respond, and the way they responded was to call me into the office and give me a formal written reprimand, which said that I had impugned the impartiality of the newspaper, the irony, of course, being this at the height of Judy Miller's personal stenography for Lewis Scooter Libby, And that I wasn't allowed to speak out about the war anymore. And at that point, I started looking for something else to do because I just wasn't going to be muzzled. You know, I'm one of the few Americans in this country, one of a few thousand who has intimate experience in the Middle East and, of course, months of my life in Iraq. And I just felt that it was worth leaving the paper, which I did, over that issue. I wasn't going to stop speaking.
You know, we had on this program a couple of years ago, Robert Fisk of The Independent in London, who's also covered the region quite a bit. And he told an interesting story that your comments now just reminded me of, which was how oftentimes when he's in Beirut or in the Middle East and he's in hotel bars with American journalists, they'll tell wonderful stories and have great insights. And then he'd say he'd read their articles and they were flat, hardly had anything of interest in them compared to what they actually knew. And he always thought that was sort of a paradox of American journalism, that the conventions of our trade sort of stripped out the most interesting insights these correspondents had.
It's even worse than that. If you get up and repeat stereotypes, either about the Muslim world or about ourselves, I mean, for instance, if I had got up at Rockford College and said, America is the greatest country on the earth, we bring democracy and liberation to the unenlightened masses of the Middle East, well, everybody would have applauded, the New York Times would have said nothing, and I would have gone home. And I think that for those of us who speak truth to that counter-narrative, then it becomes, especially on the Middle East, it becomes very precarious professionally. I mean, Bob is right. There's not a serious Middle East correspondent in this country who would, I think, disagree with virtually anything that I said. Most of them just aren't foolish enough to get up and say it. Not those who care about their careers.
Our guest, Chris Hedges. Again, the number here at WILLAM 580-333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Chris Hedges, the former New York Times correspondent, author of many books, including the new one, When Atheism Becomes Religion. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Let's start with line one. Champaign County, you're on the air with Chris Hedges.
Yes, great. Another great show. I hope that you are doing well as an independent author and speaking tours, and that you're well able to continue your writing and your
buy my books.
There you go. I was giving you an invitation to say that. Yeah, I wanted you to comment on two things. One is, I understand from Chomsky's writing that there was a recent poll done in Afghanistan that showed that Najibullah was the hands-down favorite when people were asked who their preferred political figure was. I think it was a high plurality as opposed to any kind of majority. He was the I brought this up on when Barsamian was on last week, but I think it's an important concept because it kind of undermines the idea that they're all wild-eyed Muslims if they're hearkening back to a leader in the communist era that was overthrown by the Mujahideen. And that one I'd like for you to just comment on about how misapprehended the area is. And the other thing is the lack of any mention of the SOFA agreement in Iraq's plebiscite. It seems to me that we may have a replay of the famous non-plebiscite that was recommended in Vietnam, going back that far, if you will, to the Eisenhower period. I just wonder whether they're going to let that plebiscite go ahead. This was the popular ratification of the Status of Forces Agreement that allows the American troops to stay in there. I really have no idea where Iraqis would go on this if they were allowed a free and fair vote. And I think there probably are a lot of people in Foggy Bottom and other places that are quite worried about what might happen, and I think there'll probably be a reason not to let it happen. So I'd like for you to react to both of those, and I appreciate your work.
Well, starting with the SOFA agreement, I mean, I think that's actually a really important point.
Chris, could you explain what a SOFA agreement is for some of our listeners?
It's the Status of Forces Agreement, which allows the caller said, a plebiscite for Iraqis to decide whether American or NATO forces can stay or not. And, you know, it's pretty clear from at least all indications we have, and polls are always suspect in dictatorships in wartime, that most Iraqis would want Americans out. I think I read a poll once that like 8% want them to stay. Now, there's no question that they're not leaving. So my guess is they'll just tweak it semantically. They'll you know, you already have Obama saying, well, you know, we will withdraw all combat forces, but now we're hearing that they are taking combat units and just renaming them non-combat units. My suspicion is that, you know, once again, you'll get that tremendous capacity of doublespeak where, you know, we obey, but we do not comply, as a great Salvadoran colonel once told me. I think that we'll see a very similar kind of dancing around, so that if the plebiscite is fair and if Iraqis call for a withdrawal of American troops, you know, the at least to the outside world, the hypocrisy of the Obama administration's decision to keep them there will become readily apparent, if it's not to the American public, which gets spun pretty effectively. In terms of Afghanistan, you know, what is the Taliban? I mean, you know, the Taliban is not a centralized group. It's, I think there's something like 17 different factions that make it up. It's Pashtun-driven. You know, I think the best example of what the Taliban is came when American forces went in, and with very light numbers, to empower the Northern Alliance, sort of essentially giving them air cover. And you would have Northern Alliance commanders go down and surround cities like Kandahar and spend 2 or 3 days negotiating and sending in suitcases full of cash given to them by the CIA, and then suddenly these quote-unquote Taliban forces would walk out of the city and embrace their cousins or members of their clan and melt away and suddenly become members of the Northern Alliance. There really wasn't a lot of killing initially. That's how the Taliban just merged into the victorious forces. And I think most people in Afghanistan see the way the winds are blowing, understand that Karzai is a spent force, that the occupation is doomed, and they better throw their lot in with the Taliban. I mean, you know, the issue for the Pashtuns are not, they're not waging war against the United States. They're not Al-Qaeda. They want to go back to the power arrangement that they had in 2001 before the Americans came in. They've built an alliance with the Taliban in order to achieve that. And so to use terms like Taliban and assume once again that they're monolithic, I think is not a close reading of Afghanistan. And I think, again, your caller is right. Most Afghanis are very wary of the Taliban and the right-wing forces, and we saw this during the war in the Soviets because there were pretty powerful and credible, largely secular, resistance movements against the Soviets. But, of course, courtesy of Washington and the CIA, we made sure that they withered and died, and we gave all of our money to Mekhtiar and, you know, the most radical of the Islamic groups, very tied in with the Saudis and the ISI, which is the intelligence agency of Pakistan, because I guess we thought these were the most effective fighters and because this is what the Pakistanis told us to do. So we, ironically, have over time, you know, the American forces are coming into Afghanistan mid-history here. Our involvement in Afghanistan goes back to the early 80s when we were the engine of the Mujahideen, or the resistance forces against the Soviets. And so Afghanis have a very wary view of the United States because they remember during the Soviet occupation whose side we were on and who we had turned against. We have very little credibility in Afghanistan because of that, coupled with the use of airstrikes. You know, anybody who has been, as I have, bombed, you know, by, I was bombed by MiGs, but bombed by F-16s or jet fighters and had 500 and 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bombs dropped in their midst, finds it laughable that somehow these are surgical, or that you can control when you're hurling out over, you know, a huge area, deadly bits of iron fragments, you know, that these are weapons that are targeted exclusively against insurgent fighters. It's these are very blunt instruments and ones that always take down. They're essentially blind. They take down huge numbers of civilian casualties, which we euphemistically call collateral damage, in every conflict I've ever covered. And, of course, we just had this situation where probably over 100 civilians were killed in a bombing raid. This will be repeated again and again and again. And we are the best recruiting weapon that the Taliban has.
Our guest, Chris Hodges. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines to another patient caller. Line 4, Ottawa, you're on the air with Chris Hodges.
It's an honor to speak with you, gentlemen. I was sort of thinking of Afghanistan in terms of the film version of Catch-22 when Art Garfunkel was talking to the old Italian man, and he says, Italy's going to win the war because we're weak, and America's strong, and you're going to have to go home. And in light of sort of that contradiction, I was wondering what your opinion is of our best way to get out of there, the quickest way. I suppose the theory is we're going to try to stabilize the government in power and somehow empower them to keep fighting while we leave, the sort of Vietnamization of Afghanistan, maybe. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I think that this notion that we are a force for stability in Iraq and Afghanistan is a misreading. We are a force for instability. We are another deadly mix in that cauldron of kidnapping rings and rogue militias and mercenary forces that deliver unmitigated terror on a daily basis to large numbers of Iraqi and Afghan civilians. So, of course, the supposition in any argument that opposes immediate withdrawal is that we are a stabilizing influence, and that's just not the case. I would like to see a negotiated, I'm not saying it won't, you know, Iraq especially may tear itself to pieces once we leave. You know, the best would be to try and back out in a responsible manner. If we continue this doomed policy of trying to, quote-unquote, win or achieve victory, whatever that means, then we will just reach a point of physical, emotional, and probably financial exhaustion and just walk away. So, you know, what I'm arguing for is essentially making the best of a very bad situation. A situation that largely we broke. I mean, the tragedy, especially in Iraq, is that we had a policy against Saddam Hussein that worked. It was a policy of containment. We had draconian sanctions. His military was a shadow of what it had been before the first Gulf War. He was locked away in huge palaces writing bizarre romance novels. His heir apparent, Uday, was nearly killed and crippled in an assassination attempt. The regime was withering away, and if we had been patient, we would have achieved what we wanted, which is probably another Sunni dictatorship, one that was willing to build a more amenable relationship with the West. Instead, we took a policy that was working and broke it, and now we're paying the consequences for it.
Our guest, Chris Hodges. Mr. Hodges, I'd like to turn now to another topic. There's so much ground to cover, and I want to touch some of the other work that you've done. You wrote a book that was a bestseller. I alluded to it already, American Fascist. And I was wondering what your assessment is of the Christian right today in the United States as a political force, where it stands compared to when you wrote the book, and what you see going forward as the prospects for American fascism.
I look at the Christian right as a mass movement, and I think probably the most frightening and dangerous mass movement in American history. It is extremely different from every other religious revival movement that we have seen in the country going back to the Great Awakening of 1740, because for the first time, and this, of course, was something that would differentiate even in the recent past from people like Billy Graham. For the first time, it has fused the iconography and language of American nationalism with the iconography and language of American Christianity and called for the assumption of secular power. That we have never seen before. They still use the traditional language of evangelicalism and fundamentalism, but they are a wholly new animal. It is about achieving the Christian state. The movement, because it tied itself so closely to George Bush, and he turned out to be such an unmitigated disaster, has been hurt. I think withdrawn in many ways from certainly the national politics, not so much local politics. But the engine of the movement is personal and economic despair. For my book, which I spent 2 years on, and I spent a lot of time traveling all around the country and spending hours and hours in mega churches and pro-life weekends and creationist seminars, all this kind of stuff, you hear the stories of the followers of the movement, and you'd have to be heartless not to be moved by the pain that these people have undergone, a severe financial distress, struggles with addictions, domestic abuse, sexual abuse. I mean, just as a little window, you know, when I covered the pro-life movement, I was at a retreat for women involved in the movement in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and they asked all the post-abortive sisters to stand, which was almost the whole room. And in the course of interviews, I found that these women had not only had one abortion, but most of them had had multiple abortions. And the movement very effectively played against their sense of shame and their guilt, including organizing weekends where these women would go away and they would give them dolls. And they would tell them that these are the children that they have murdered. And they would be told to name their dolls and dress them and sleep with them. And at the end of the weekend, offer them up to God and beg for forgiveness and dedicate themselves to fighting and destroying the culture of death, which is us. Once you get inside these mega churches, there is a cult-like quality to how they operate. There is no questioning of the pastor, who is invariably male and white and in direct communication with God. Any kind of questioning is, the forces of Satan and backsliding. I did a conversion seminar with D. James Kennedy in Fort Lauderdale for a week, and it was very callous in that they consciously target people who are broken. I mean, they told us this. I write about it in a chapter. And you look for people who have just lost a job, people who are have just lost a loved one, people who have just moved to an area and don't have friends. And you send in groups of three. You're intensely interested. They call it building friends, but of course it's a false friendship. Cults use the same thing. Margaret Singer, who studied cults like the Moonies, called it love bombing. So the inside of this movement is terrifying. It certainly, these people, I'm talking about the leadership, they understand and manipulate the despair, the profound despair that has gripped many of their followers, both for financial gain. Many of them are very wealthy. Figures like Pat Robertson, we don't know exactly, but are worth hundreds of millions, some people say up to $1 billion dollars in personal wealth. And they manipulate these people for political gain. Now, I think that, the one thing we are probably going to have a surplus of in the coming months in American society is despair. Mm-hmm. And I think that this movement remains a potent and destabilizing and dangerous force in American society.
Well, in one of your pieces in Truth Dig that I was just reading not too long ago, you were talking about the economy and what's happening with the economy. And by the logic of your argument, it's going to be a breeding ground for recruitment for this movement.
This movement and other right-wing movements. And remember, in American society, unlike, for instance, Canadian society, there is a very dark undercurrent of violence, a frightening undercurrent of violence. So, look, I'm not the only one to think of this. I mean, Dennis Blair, when he testified before the Senate, talked about domestic unrest and preparing for domestic unrest.
Well, related to this, when he was reading about the economy, I was struck by the fact that you called yourself a socialist, which is, in America until recently, I guess, with your column, it was sort of like announcing you were a pedophile in our political culture. What do you mean by that, and how does that relate to the situation we're in today?
Well, we're all socialists now. I wanted it on the record that I became one before George Bush. It's who, you know, socialism is just heavy government intervention in the society, primarily to take care of the weak, mentally ill. I mean, you know, we live in a very cruel nation. I mean, I've lived in Europe, studied France, studied in Switzerland and France, and, you know, we throw our mentally ill out on the sidewalk, 25% of whom are in prisons. You know, 50 million of them, roughly, Americans don't have health insurance, and probably another 50 million are underinsured, meaning that if they get a catastrophic illness, they're not covered. Half of all bankruptcies in this country are caused by people who can't pay their medical bills. We've completely disenfranchised the American working class. Real wages have been declining since 1973. You know, it's the callousness of the society and the rise of an American oligarchy is something that is coupled, you know, with that economic shift has seen a real erosion of our democracy. And this isn't a new idea. I mean, Thucydides and Plutarch wrote about it, about Athenian democracy, that once you create an oligarchy, a democracy has become cannot be sustained. I'm a socialist the way a Swede is a socialist or a Swiss is a socialist. When I lived in Switzerland, half of all taxes went to, half of all income were taxed or were sent to the government. But they had, you know, school teachers in Switzerland earned as much as doctors. It's one of the best healthcare systems in the world. If you're, you know, there aren't any homeless out on the street. If you're mentally ill, you're taken care of. If you have a catastrophic illness, you're taken care of. There's an egalitarianism within the society. You don't have the ultra-rich, or not many of them. People have to live modestly. But there's a kind of, you build community through that rather than destroy it the way that you do in unfettered and unregulated capitalism. So,
you know, if I can interrupt, Mr. Hedges, it strikes me that as I hear you and as I've read your stuff that, you know, there's a real failure of our political system, because what you're talking about is simply not anywhere near legitimate debate. There's no, as far as I can tell, political party that's advancing these politics at all. It's simply completely in the margins, even though I suspect a lot of these positions would be widely embraced if people knew about them.
Yeah, well, you're very right. It is shut out of the debate, and quite consciously. I mean, you know, the media, which is, there's roughly 8 corporations, I think, that control almost everything we see, hear, and read. And they don't want universal, single-payer, not-for-profit health care discussed, because I think the last poll was 50% of all doctors want it, a huge percentage. I don't know if it's a majority, but yeah, of course it would be immensely popular. And so the way they deal with it is just never bringing it up. And people who try and bring it up, like, for instance, Kucinich, are not allowed to debate. I mean, in the New Hampshire debate, he was standing out in a snowbank, locked out of Iowa, locked out of Nevada, because, you know, in Iowa, these debates are all sponsored by private corporations, by for-profit corporations. In Iowa, the debate was actually sponsored by for-profit healthcare industry. Yeah, you're right. These issues are just not discussed. You have marginal figures, Ralph Nader, Cynthia McKinney, who will bring it up, but they're, or Kucinich did during the Democratic primaries, but they're not. They're quite consciously not given a voice, and we have become a very deformed society because of that.
You know, you just spoke very critically of our news media, and you write critically about it. Did you see changes in the newsroom during the course of your 2 decades at the Times and other U.S. mainstream news media, or were these problems that have been there all along?
I did see changes. I think the parameters narrowed significantly from when I began, so that while there was a place for figures like me and Cy Hirsch and at the beginning, when I started, there was no place by the time I finished. Television news has been the change has been most disturbing in the electronic media. When I started covering the war in El Salvador, the networks all had bureaus, they had correspondents. You know, they tended to like the bang bang stuff a bit too much, but they got out, they reported, they produced stories. That's all gone. It's all this fusion of celebrity gossip and chat and, you know, how we're made to feel and ratings, you know, infotainment, which, as Neil Postman said in his great book, you know, we're amusing ourselves to death. I just wrote a book that'll be out in July called The Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. The dying or decaying societies finally unmoor themselves completely from reality.
Chris, we'll have you on to talk about that book for a full hour when it comes out, so which I'll look very much forward to. What do you tell young people who want to be journalists today in view of the what's happening in newsrooms, what's happening with journalism in general? And I get this. I suspect you do, too. You know, people desperately, young people want to become journalists and do good stuff.
It's not economically sustainable. That's the problem. You know, when I began, you could freelance for publications, or you could get a job in a small newspaper. But as all of these revenue sources are being extinguished, there's no shortage of people with a conscience or talent out there. But they don't have the avenue that I had in order to actually build and begin a career. You know, how long can you write for free and pay your rent on Huffington Post? And that is a very disturbing situation, because the death of newspapers is not just the death of newsprint, but it's the death of, I think, one of the pillars of our democracy. You know, no internet site is ever going to replicate the Los Angeles Times newsroom, which even with all of the cuts still employs 700 people, or the New York Times with 1,200 people. You know, so I think that we'll descend into kind of monastic entities. You know, you'll have Slate or Salon or ProPublica or Truthdig or whatever. But these are very small operations in comparison. And you won't have that, you know, a newspaper would arrive on your doorstep in the neighborhood or city that you lived, and there was, you know, it was it's a completely different ethic, in that a reporter would seek to be as accurate as they could. It would be vetted through editors. The internet is the opposite. You throw anything out, and then if people challenge it, it may or may not be corrected. And I think the other problem with the internet is people feed off of traditional news sources. There's very little reporting done on the internet. You know, people won't even pick up a phone, much less go out and report. And people on the internet tend to gravitate towards sites that reinforce their belief system, which, and there are many problems with traditional newspapers, but at least newspapers gave you news that you didn't ask for, didn't want.
Now, some people, Chris, had just say, well, you know, it's just a matter of transition, like when other new technologies came along, and that eventually the market and technology will work its magic, and they'll figure out a way to provide quality journalism with resources to back it up online. Are you optimistic in that area?
No, because the advertisers are not going to the internet, even on the newspaper sites. If you look at sites like the New York Times site, it's less than 10% of advertising revenue is web advertising. So you have most traditional advertisers clinging to the dying print medium and not transferring to the internet.
Chris Hedges, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio for the next show.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be sure to have you on when your new book comes out. You said in July?
Yes.
Terrific. We'll look for it. Chris Hedges, again, thank you for joining us on Media Matters. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff, my engineer, and Andrew Boyle, for my producer, for their work today. I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone have a great week, and I'll be back in 167 hours. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Our forecast for today calls for a sunny day and a high of 65, winds from the northeast at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Clear skies tonight, the low of 40 with winds light and from the south. Continued sunny, mostly sunny for Monday, and a high of 70 degrees, south winds at 7 to 14 miles an hour. Mostly clear Monday night with a low of 48. Tuesday mostly sunny, the high 77, sunshine and 78 for Wednesday. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.